There was no collusion at all. No collusion.
Well, he was a lawyer for me for one of many. They always say the lawyer, and then they like to add the fixer. Well, I don't know if he's a fixer.
So Rudy knows it's a witch hunt. He started yesterday. He'll get his facts straight.
I understood Michael Cohen very well. He turned out he wasn't a very good lawyer, frankly.
Says who?
This is Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers, a special series from Left, Right, and Center. Our show is all about President Trump's legal issues. They're complicated, and they bring up really good questions about free speech and defamation and Twitter and what Jeff Bezos and Karen McDougal have in common. It was clear we needed to devote some time every week to answering some of these big legal questions. So I called Ken White. Ken is a criminal defense attorney in Los Angeles and was formerly a federal prosecutor. He blogs about the law at popehat.com. He hosts the First Amendment podcast, Make No Law, and he's my co-host and legal navigator on this show. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Josh.
Did you read anything good on Medium this week?
I the oddest piece from the head of Amazon. I really didn't expect it.
Yeah, I know this wasn't that big, so you may not have noticed this going around on the internet, but if you are, you know, especially online, you may have seen this piece by Amazon CEO and richest man in the world, Jeff Bezos. It was compelling and a little bit adult. As a fair warning, Ken and I are going to be talking here about a photograph of Jeff Bezos's genitalia because it is unfortunately legally relevant this week. You'll recall a few weeks ago, the National Enquirer reported an affair that Jeff Bezos was having. Jeff Bezos was obviously upset about that, and he launched an investigation into how and why the Enquirer obtained his private text messages and were therefore able to disclose his affair. There are some theories. The National Enquirer has been aligned with President Trump, and the president considers Jeff Bezos, who owns the Washington Post, to be a political opponent. You'll recall that during the 2016 campaign, American Media, the company that owns the National Enquirer, purchased a story from Karen McDougal, who said she had an affair with President Trump. They bought the story not to publish it, but to bury it, thereby protecting President Trump from its publication. But was that an illegal campaign contribution? AMI and its president, David Pecker, have been cooperating with the Southern District of New York investigations into people around the Trump Organization, including Michael Cohen. Those investigations relate to the question of whether the payment from AMI to McDougal was an illegal campaign contribution. There's also a Saudi angle. AMI published this odd, glossy, ad-free pro-Saudi magazine last year. Why did they do that? Bezos hired a fancy consultant named Gavin DeBecker, who started asking nosy questions about the Enquirer and AMI and their relationship to President Trump in Saudi Arabia, trying to figure out whether any of that had to do with their interest in Jeff Bezos and his affair. That didn't please AMI at all, and the National Enquirer sent a threatening letter to Bezos, saying it had his personal photos, including one showing his penis, and they threatened to publish those photos if he did not cease his investigation into AMI and publicly declare that they had no political motive for reporting on his affair. Bezos did not accede to that threat. Instead, he published their threat letter saying he would not be extorted. And here we are. Ken, is what AMI did here a crime? Is it extortion? Is it blackmail?
Well, I'm going to give you the answer that you knew I was going to give, Josh, and that's maybe. So extortion is a complicated area of the law because it's legal to threaten to do a lot of things and to harm people's reputation in some circumstances. If I'm mad at my favorite food truck, I can tell them, you know, refund my money or I'm going to put up a nasty review on Yelp. I'm allowed to do that. So a threat has to be wrongful for it to be extortion under federal law. And the trick is determining when is a threat wrongful. When is it just bargaining over mutually dueling lawsuits, and when is it extortion? Generally, courts have suggested that wrongful means, in this type of context, disconnected to any sort of legitimate claim of right. The classic example is a case, a real blast from the past around 20 years ago, involving Bill Cosby. A woman named Autumn Jackson came out of the woodwork claiming to be his daughter, and with the help of some friends, demanded $40 million not to go to the tabloids and tell the story about how she was his secret daughter. And they went to trial for extortion. And what the court said about it was that that was potentially extortion because the claim for $40 million based on the idea you may or may not be this person's daughter is so disconnected from any claim of right that that demand could be wrongful.
Well, so then what about the fact pattern here where American media basically is aggrieved because they the accusation seems to be that Bezos is fomenting false accusations about them?
It is very much whether or not they have a legitimate right as a claim of right to ask that someone not only stop investigating but make a public statement. It might come down to whether a jury agrees that this particular demand was really connected to something that they had a right to ask for, or whether it was completely disconnected. It was not a claim of right. And I really don't know how a judge or a jury would come out on that.
What about this thing where in order to be extortion, you have to be seeking a thing of value from the person that you are extorting? Now, classically, you might, you know, say, give me $40 million, as the case with Autumn Jackson. Clearly, $40 million is a thing of value. Is ceasing an investigation and making a public statement a thing of value within the definition of the law around extortion?
That is the other gray area of this situation. I think that the demand for the public statement is probably most clearly the thing of value. Asking that he cease the investigation is a little cloudier. It's probably the part about ceasing the investigation that I think brings this closest to extortion, because there's really no theory under which you can say that you have a legitimate interest in someone stopping an investigation, looking into something. You could have a legitimate interest in them not spreading rumors or making statements, but saying they can stop, look into it, particularly when you're a journalistic, putatively, institution, I think that's probably the part that has the most powerful argument that it's wrongful, that it's not connected to a claim of right.
So we're describing here how it would be difficult to make this case in a court of law, that you have a number of these gray areas and, you know, in order to convict somebody, you have to convict them beyond a reasonable doubt. So there would be a lot of defenses available to AMI if they were accused of having criminally extorted Jeff Bezos here. But I don't think we're really talking about the idea that AMI might be indicted and tried for extortion, because AMI is currently under a non-prosecution agreement that the Southern District of New York was investigating these hush payments related to the 2016 campaign. AMI was one of the entities that ended up being investigated as part of that. And AMI agreed to cooperate with that investigation as they look into presumably other entities like the Trump Organization and people who work in and around the Trump Organization. AMI is a cooperator in that investigation. And as part of that cooperation, there's this non-prosecution agreement where AMI, among other things, has agreed that it will not commit any more crimes while it cooperates with the Southern District of New York in its investigation into that stuff around the 2016 campaign. So if you're under a non-prosecution agreement and the government comes to believe that you have committed a crime, like, say, extortion, they don't have to convict you in a court of law of extortion in order to be able to revoke that non-prosecution agreement. It's a lower standard, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's really somewhat subjective on behalf of the government. AMI's non-prosecution agreement is pretty standard. It does say that they shall commit no crimes whatsoever. It doesn't say except for penis-related ones. And it says that if the government
has... Always got to get that penis carve out.
Yeah, exactly. It does say if the government has determined that you've committed a crime, it can revoke this non-prosecution promise. And as Paul Manafort recently has been litigating and conceding in court over the government's claim that he violated his agreement, it's really a subjective determination by the prosecution. So I think that the allegation of extortion here, while possibly close to the line and tricky, is certainly enough for prosecutors to say that they have breached their non-prosecution agreement.
So we're now in this situation where AMI made this threat to Jeff Bezos. Bezos did not accede to the threat. Instead, he published it. And so we're still in the situation where the National Enquirer, at least in theory, has these photographs of Jeff Bezos, at least one of which shows his penis, and they have threatened that they might publish those photos. So suppose they decided to do that. It seems like there are a few areas of law that Jeff Bezos might resort to protect himself. First, he says in the Medium post about the National Enquirer that he owns the copyright to these photos, including the one that shows his penis, and that AMI would be infringing that copyright if they published it. Is that right?
You know, it might be, but it's probably the weakest of his arguments. Copyright is the wrong tool to go after this type of tabloid-based revealing a picture you don't want other people to see. It's better suited when people are using that picture. I mean, if AMI were going to do a coffee table book about Jeff Bezos' penis, then he might have an argument that they're profiting off of the text. But this is close. It's probably determined by a doctrine called fair use, where you can use things that are copyrighted in a limited extent for newsworthy purposes, for commentary, for criticism, and that sort of thing. There's a multi-factor test. And so the question would be, what is the fair use of Jeff Bezos' penis?
But wait, why is that photo newsworthy? I mean, even if the existence of the photo is newsworthy, you can report its existence by describing it. You don't actually need to publish it in order to inform the public about it, right?
It's newsworthy because we all suck, Josh. It's newsworthy because we like this sort of terrible thing. Another fair use factor is about the impact on the market. So you have to ask, does the publisher's use diminish the market for the product from the person who owns the copyright? So it's not like Jeff Bezos was going to be making money publishing texts of his penis. And I'm given to understand that men in general dramatically overvalue the market for these things. So I think it's a very strong fair use argument. There are much better torts and claims that Bezos could use to go after AMI.
Well, so let's talk about that, because this seems very similar to the Hulk Hogan case that ended up bankrupting Gawker Media, where Gawker published this sex tape of Hulk Hogan, and Hulk Hogan sued, I believe, on invasion of privacy and won a very large judgment against Gawker and some of its employees for having published that. So would this be a similar situation where if they published this, Jeff Bezos could sue because they invaded his privacy?
He could certainly try invasion of privacy, maybe intentional infliction of emotional distress, maybe civil extortion. You know, a creative lawyer could probably come up with a number of theories. And a litigator will tell you sometimes that if your facts are horrific enough, you know, all the ties are going to go to you. And that's kind of like the Gawker situation. Sometimes the conduct is just so repulsive to judges and juries that, you know, even if it seems like a stretch, the legal claim, they're going to give it to you. And I think AMI would be in serious trouble with any judge and any jury, even if the actual legal claims are somewhat tenuous.
Are there any angles we've missed on Jeff Bezos' penis? Are there other legal risks here for AMI that we should be advising them of before they decide whether to publish these photos?
Well, again, the world we live in is both legal and practical. And even if it's legal for them to do it, practically it inflames people. And when you're already under federal investigation, you've probably breached your non-prosecution agreement, and you're already very unpopular with this Justice Department. I think that doing so would be even more of a red flag. And what you have to understand is that even if this isn't the federal crime of extortion, what we've seen recently, again and again, is that the process of investigation itself tends to generate crimes. So in the special counsel investigation, we've seen again and again people getting charged not for underlying bad behavior, but for lying during the process or intimidating witnesses or what have you. And so just the process of a revved up investigation of AMI and its executives would be very dangerous for them.
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we will talk more about non-disclosure agreements. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. This is Josh Barrow, and I'm back with attorney Ken White on All the President's Lawyers. Former White House aide Cliff Sims, the author of the recent tell-all book Den of Vipers about infighting in the Trump White House, is suing the president over the president's efforts to enforce a non-disclosure agreement against him. His lawsuit alleges the president is using his campaign to seek retribution against former government employees like him for exercising their First Amendment rights. He also says the president is seeking to punish his disclosure of information he learned solely during his government service. The campaign had been seeking to force him into arbitration over the NDA, which would have been secret. Sims is suing in court, which is very public. So, Ken, it feels like we've seen this story before, both with Sam Nunberg and with Stormy Daniels, where the president tries to do something quietly in arbitration, and then that completely fails, and he ends up in open court with the fight in front of the whole world.
Yeah, he's not a real lesson learner, is he? I think that there's some merit to this new lawsuit that this author is bringing. I mean, Trump is trying to do what presidents have dreamed of doing for many decades, prevent people from writing tell-all books about the administration. And there's a decent argument here that the Trump campaign, which is the one nominally trying to take this guy into arbitration and to enforce this nondisclosure, is really just a cutout for the United States government. In other words, that the Trump campaign doesn't really have any legitimate interest in policing what happens after Trump is in office, and that a private entity can't somehow prevent a civil servant from talking about their civil service. I think that argument is going to be difficult for Trump to get around, because if what he's doing is okay, then, you know, every government actor out there could just use a private entity to cut contracts with all their underlings in the government and use this technique to stop them from ever talking.
Can an NDA be void simply for being against the public interest? I mean, suppose they allege that Sims disclosed information he learned in a campaign capacity. It's hard for me to see what the public interest is in a political campaign being able to bully and shut up its former employees.
Well, no, that's very enforceable. I mean, you could enforce an NDA to the extent you say that you're not going to talk about what you saw and overheard during the campaign when Trump was a private actor. But once he's in the government, I think it's very questionable whether you can enforce a private contract to stop him from talking about that. I mean, there are whistleblower statutes, Josh, that protect people in the government that want to go and talk about things. There are robust First Amendment rights for government employees. And I think it is doubtful that a court's going to let Trump get around them by this gambit.
Let's talk about Paul Manafort. We've talked a fair bit on this show about the allegation from Robert Mueller's team that Paul Manafort breached his cooperation agreement with prosecutors by repeatedly lying to them. And there have been a number of proceedings about this before Judge Amy Berman Jackson. There was recently a sealed hearing where prosecutors were supposed to explain why Manafort's lies were important. And according to a transcript of that hearing that was heavily redacted, prosecutor Andrew Weissman laid out a case about communications between Manafort and Konstantin Kalimnik, who is a known agent of Russian intelligence. Here's how the New York Times describes it. Quote, Mr. Manafort and Mr. Kalimnik repeatedly communicated about a so-called peace plan for Ukraine starting in early August 2016, while Mr. Manafort was still running Mr. Trump's campaign, and continuing into 2018, months after Mr. Manafort had been charged by the special counsel's office with a litany of crimes related to his work in the country. The prosecutors claim that Mr. Manafort misled them about those talks and other interactions with Mr. Kalimnik. Andrew Weissman went on in the hearing to say that this pattern of lies, quote, goes to the larger view of what we think is going on and what we think is the motive here, adding, this goes, I think, very much to the heart of what the special counsel's office is investigating. So, Kent, how significant is this? Some people are taking this to mean that the Manafort prosecution wasn't just about some interesting felonies that Mueller found while looking into the shady people who came to be around Donald Trump. That the investigation relates to a conspiracy to obtain policy commitments from Trump related to Russia during and perhaps after the campaign. Can we read that into this?
Possibly. It could be the attorney just overblowing it a little bit or speaking generally, but it hints at the possibility that special counsel is looking into a theory that the Trump campaign was promising particular foreign policy outcomes in exchange for something. And if there was that promise, that exchange, then you're getting into real criminal territory.
This would explain why Mueller kept the Manafort prosecution for his own, because there have been other sort of similar prosecutions related to lobbying and influence peddling and unregistered foreign agent activity, like the investigation into the Podesta Group and Mercury Public Affairs, that Mueller has passed off to be prosecuted or at least investigated by the Southern District of New York. But this one he prosecuted himself.
Right. It could be that he wanted a secure hold on Manafort and wanted to flip him and use him. And that didn't turn out well, obviously, because he's accusing Manafort of breaching that cooperation agreement and lying. But him keeping this stuff that is otherwise somewhat collateral does suggest that he thinks it's connected to his core investigation.
Isn't there another plausible read here that is less damaging to President Trump, which is to say that whatever else Paul Manafort has been up to for the last few years, it's clear that he was using Trump, that he believed that getting close to Trump and becoming the chairman of his campaign would help him make money. In particular, it might get the Russian oligarch Oleg Deripaska to stop trying to collect money that he felt Manafort owed him. Isn't it plausible that Manafort made commitments to Russians without Donald Trump's sign-off or even knowledge? And after all, Trump has not done exactly what the Russians wanted in Ukraine. We've not recognized a peace settlement there. We've not recognized the Russian annexation of Crimea. We still have most of the sanctions in place there.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's a very strong defense for the Trump team. I mean, it's become increasingly clear that the Trump campaign was just awash in a sea of grifters, and Manafort was one of them. And, you know, even the prosecution says that he's a habitual liar. So the defense that anything he said he wasn't authorized to say would be a very difficult one for the special counsel to get around. So to get around that defense, they would have to find evidence of more senior people in the Trump campaign knowing about, endorsing, directing these sorts of communications.
Should we assume that there is such a thing as the heart of the investigation? That's in the Weissman quote. This goes very much to the heart of what the special counsel's office is investigating.
It's misleading to even suggest that a federal investigation necessarily has one heart. It's more like a weird alien creature that has its organs migrating all over the place. The feds have a general sense, kind of a gist of what they're looking into. And then they go charging in, looking into that. And what they find out leads them in all these different directions. And if their aim is, you know, we think this person probably did something wrong, what can we develop showing that? Then that heart, if you call it that, might migrate from one place to another.
Finally, let's talk about Roger Stone and Jerome Corsi, because this is an amusing week for them. Corsi is suing Stone for defamation. Jerome Corsi is the conspiracy theorist most known for popularizing the false claim that Barack Obama was not born in the United States. Stone and Corsi had dealings together related to the WikiLeaks email releases in the 2016 election campaign. Stone has now been indicted for lying to Robert Mueller's investigators, and Corsi is probably also going to be indicted. We know that he rejected a plea offer from the Mueller team also related to lying to investigators. Corsi says Stone defamed him. Specifically, he says Stone falsely accused Corsi of lying to investigators to incriminate Stone. Stone, of course, went on InfoWars to make these allegations, and he said, for example, that Corsi lied under oath, that he made a false claim to investigators about the reason that he wrote a memo for Stone, that he falsely accused Stone of knowing about the Podesta emails in advance. Ken, do these statements that Corsi highlights from Stone, do they sound like they could be actionable defamation to you?
Some of them are potentially false statements of fact, as opposed to opinion. But the analysis would be somewhat clouded by the fact he did it on places like InfoWars. So when a court is looking at whether something is a statement of fact that can be defamation or an opinion that can't be, they look at the context and how people familiar with that context view it. That's why President Trump has skated with things he said on Twitter, because people understand that UBS on Twitter. And the defense might be everyone understands if you go on InfoWars, you're just bloviating. I mean, it's headed by a guy who rips off his shirt and screams into the microphone. So that would be the defense. But I think I don't know if this lawsuit is really about winning or losing about the merits as opposed to disruption. The lawsuit presents the opportunity to take discovery, which can it can hurt Stone or it can interfere with the special counsel's prosecution of Stone. And it's all, there are all sorts of ways it could potentially disrupt not only the subsequent indictment of Corsi himself, but the course of the prosecution of Stone. So I'm not sure whether these people are really acting as genuine aggrieved litigants or whether they're more chaos agents in filing this.
So that's interesting, because I looked at this and thought, you know, if I'm thinking that I'm likely to be indicted for lying to federal investigators, I don't want to then initiate a discovery process that could discover documents and obtain statements that might strengthen the government's case that I lied about things. It seems like the risk would here primarily be to the litigants, but you think the risk might actually be to the federal prosecutors?
Well, not from a smart defense lawyer point of view, but if you're Jerome Corsi, I mean, Larry Klayman is known for lawsuits that are very performative.
This is Corsi's lawyer.
Right. Of course it is. And CoreSci strategy all along has been, look at me. And he may think that that sort of thing is more useful to him than actually things that would be smart to do to defend yourself in a criminal prosecution. Just as if we speculated that sometimes some of these people are not so much gunning for an acquittal as they are trying to set themselves up for a pardon. So absolutely, normally you would never, never file a defamation lawsuit when you're under risk of indictment, because if you do, you're basically waiving your right to remain silent. Roger Stone can now take the deposition of Jerome CoreSci, and CoreSci has to make the decision, do I take the Fifth and then my civil suit goes away, or do I answer all the questions and further incriminate myself?
Can we talk about the merits of the claims in this lawsuit themselves, even if we think it's primarily performative, just because I think the merits of the claims are kind of a fun issue in this instance?
If we must.
So a theme that we've seen over and over here is that somebody makes an accusation, and then another person denies the accusation, and then the first person sues for defamation, saying that that denial of the accusation constituted a claim that the person who made the accusation was a liar, and that that statement that that person was a liar was defamatory. And this has not worked out so well, for example, with Stormy Daniels, who sued the president for saying that her claims about being threatened in a parking lot were a con job. But in this instance, when Jerome CoreSci says that Roger Stone is lying by saying that claims that CoreSci made were not true, he's saying that Roger Stone has not only said that CoreSci was lying, but that he lied under oath, that he perjured himself. So when you're not just saying that someone is lying, but that they lied in a court of law and committed perjury, that's an accusation that the person committed a crime. And so typically that's a thing that you can sue for defamation over.
I think whether or not it's going to be defamatory turns on the full statement that Roger Stone is making and the context in which he's making it. So if it can be reasonably taken as a statement of fact based on Stone's own knowledge, then yes, it can be defamatory. If the circumstances suggest that he's giving an opinion, that he's saying, you know, I think Jerome CoreSci perjured himself because of these three things, then that's going to be opinion and protected. But I think that here the circumstances and the nature of the statements are complicated enough that it wouldn't be easy for Stone to get out of it.
What about the fact that CoreSci is a big liar? Like, I mean, CoreSci is famous for lying. That's what he is known for. He makes up things like that President Obama was born in Kenya. So when Roger Stone says things like, you can tell Jerome CoreSci is lying because his lips are moving, not only is that, you know, insult and bluster and opinion, it's also correct.
Well, sure. It matters in two ways. First of all, truth is always a defense, and it's always going to be CoreSci's burden to prove that what Roger Stone said was false, to prove that what CoreSci testified about was true. And he may have difficulty with that, and he may find it very hard to get a jury to believe that anything he says is true. Second, it goes to damages. So can Jerome CoreSci's reputation possibly get any worse? He may be sliding into that category that's somewhat mythical, but lawyers talk about, that's a defamation proof, someone whose reputation is so horrible that it cannot be harmed. And courts are a little reluctant to buy into that. But, you know, every lawyer dreams of establishing that about somebody.
I think that's a good place to leave it this week. Ken White, I want to thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Josh.
If you have questions about the president's lawyers and his legal issues, send us your questions. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW and on Facebook, too. And one last thing, if you're enjoying the show and you've got 5 minutes to spare, please fill out our listener survey. Go to kcrw.com/survey to fill us in, and thank you. All the President's Lawyers is produced by Sarah Fay. Our associate producer is Rosalie Atkinson. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us. And Ken and I will be back next week with more All the President's Lawyers.